Welcome, fellow plebs. My name is Sean, and this is
Tribunus Plebis.
And welcome back to the podcast, everybody. This episode is going to run through a couple of very important NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, rulings. They all give a boost to labor all across the country. And these rulings, when connected to a memo that was actually written and issued last year, really spell out some good news for workers. Now, this episode is coming out a little bit later than intended because of the UAW strike. It demanded a proper episode to come out discussing it, and that forced me to push this one back by almost 2 weeks. But that's all okay, because these rulings and changes will affect the working class and union organizing for years to come. This isn't really a breaking news item that we want to be lost forever to our social media muddled memory holes. Now, the NLRB has been pretty bad for basically all of my life, and I'm 46 years old. And, I mean, you know, I guess it's really been bad my entire life. This isn't like, you know, oh my God, everything's been fundamentally changed into a utopia or anything like that, but these are good changes. These are changes that will earn thousands of workers thousands of more dollars a year all across the country. They'll help even more workers organize and help expedite collectively bargained contracts. And I guess I'm going to front load this even more by saying that all of this is incredibly good for organized labor in general. It's so good, I've even seen people in the labor realm start talking about Biden being the most union-friendly president of our lifetimes. Sadly, this is actually defensible, even considering how he completely destroyed a potential rail strike, which could have had huge positive effects on the working class. Calling Biden the most labor-friendly president ever is just noting which person that, you know, hits you the least when a lot of people are hitting you. While that fact may be notable, it is still abuse. The past 50 years have just been utterly atrocious for workers, and to be honest, I'm not giving this scumbag any props here, aside from him assigning new leadership to the NLRB, which has been making some decent rulings. I also want to discuss how, even though I'm going to say how good these rulings are and how improved the NLRB is and how its, you know, decisions have gotten better, this doesn't mean that we rely on Biden, the new NLRB General Counsel Jennifer Abruzzo, or any government agency to fully help us. We must, in the end, help ourselves. So no, the NLRB is not perfect. The NLRA itself is far from perfect. It's a bill that was enacted to help blunt real proletarian movements. But these recent few decisions have been the biggest and the best in recent memory, and the first one that we're going to talk about here stems from a case brought against Cemex Corporation by the Teamsters. This new rule makes it much more risky for companies to take unlawful action against their employees who are trying to organize the workplace. In the past, companies could perform unfair labor actions to delay or even redo an election to give themselves more time to either, I guess on the best view of things, to change minds, or the more realistic and cynical thing is that they could use it to help string the workers out and stifle enthusiasm for organizing. Basically, what this decision comes down to is that from now on, if workers in a shop get 50% plus one card signed, then the employer has two choices. They can either accept and recognize the union and begin negotiations on a contract, or they can petition to the NLRB for a vote. Now, this doesn't sound all that amazing, right? This is basically what happens now for all intents and purposes. But here's a twist. If the employer takes an action which is an unfair labor practice, then the union will be immediately recognized and the company must bargain with it. This ruling is, I feel like I should add here, not even really all that groundbreaking. There is an old case called Joy Silk, which was settled in the late 40s. And this case said that employers would be forced to recognize and negotiate with a union once a majority of its employees signed on. More on, you know, this aspect a little bit later. But I just wanted to note that this decision is really kind of a reestablishment of a rule which had been on the books for decades before being scuttled by some loser judges in Washington. In Joy Silk, the only way that an actual vote would take place is if either less than 50% but over 30% of workers had said that they wanted the union, or if the employees were over 50%, that the employer had good faith reasons, real, actual, defensible reasons, to think that the 50%+ was fraudulent. This was called the Joy Silk Doctrine. It would eventually be replaced by the Gissel Doctrine, which was established 20 years later. Under Gissel, the NLRB could instate what were called Gissel orders, orders for companies to recognize the union. But it added that to do so, the unfair labor practices would have to be egregious to the point of absurdity, a state which is undefined, left open to interpretation and opinion, a near impossible threshold for any particular event to meet. Post-1969, even more roadblocks to Gissel orders would be added by various decisions of the Supreme Court. Now, in reality, Joy Silk really gave the bosses an easy way to push out a vote. Any company can think of any reason at all to say that some number of votes were potentially fraudulent. And this limited its scope, but the core of it was not awful. Moving on to the case here, Cemex Construction was found to have committed over 20 distinct unfair labor practices, including threatening the livelihoods of the workers looking to legally organize their workplace. As soon as the nearly 400 cement truck drivers announced that the union drive had begun, the company reacted in opposition by forcing employees to view anti-union propaganda and by repeatedly threatening the jobs of vocal workers who had voiced their support of unionization. This ruling is saying that if workers get enough cards signed, then from that point on, any unfair labor actions which may cause a delay or setting aside of an election will result in automatic recognition of the new union. This is, to be honest with you, incredible news. Like I mentioned before, in the past, companies could basically openly commit unfair actions, be totally blatant about it, and they would get elections delayed or redone as a way to delay recognition and give them more time to persuade, threaten, or even fire workers until they get the result that they want, a company victory. These are, unfortunately, incredibly common tactics, or at least they were. Delay, 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 until workers quit, get fired, or just give up. My own company uses this tactic to defeat unionization efforts all across the country. Now, I do want to note here that this is not a full card check law. Card check is a bill which has been proposed several times, which would make getting 50%+ of employees to sign a card to immediately force a company to recognize a union. It would be good if this were a card check bill, but it just isn't. And I just wanted to be clear on that. And hello there, everybody. As most of you probably know, this podcast takes a lot of time and effort to put together and, you know, to get out there for you good folks to listen to. And you, our listeners, can help us by liking and subscribing on YouTube. So please take a second to click those little buttons. It helps a ton. And if you are feeling just a little bit more generous and you enjoy what we do here at Tribunus Plebis Media, you can help us earn just a little bit of money for the large amount of labor that we put into this thing by signing up on our Buy Me a Coffee page, where you can make a one-time donation or sign up for a recurring monthly subscription. We do all of this for free, and we will never run ads in our works. But any contributions really do help keep the show going and improving. The page address is buymeacoffee.com/tribunusplebis. And of course, all links will be in the show notes and descriptions wherever you are listening or watching. Thank you. And now, back to the episode. Now, when we combine the Cemex ruling with another recent NLRB change, this one coming 2 days after Cemex, which the NLRB is calling the quote-unquote final rule, The final rule is essentially guiding the NLRB and its regional offices to have elections much quicker than they have in the past. This is yet another way that this new NLRB is actually improving things for labor. I note this again because it has been so rare during my lifetime that these decisions, rules, and procedures have favored anything but the corporate dorks. This decision, it reads in part this, quote, regional directors will schedule elections for the earliest date practicable after issuance of a decision and direction of election, rather than observing the 20 business day waiting period imposed by the 2019 rule, end quote. The driving principle in these rules, both of them, is to provide a framework which will allow the board, the workers, and, I mean, I guess you could even say the companies, to resolve these votes as soon as possible. This is, without a doubt, a big win for organizers. Having a vote as close to an accepted card count as possible is always beneficial because this is the point where worker enthusiasm is at its peak. The benefit here for the workers is, again, to prevent these companies from abusing their workers with captive audience propaganda sessions for months on end, which are typically chock full of veiled threats, lies, and exaggerations of what it means to be in a union. Usually a lot of nonsense about being family, vilifying unions, fear-mongering strikes, and questioning the idea of paying dues. Sadly, all of these lies can actually work if companies are given enough time to repetitiously beat these threats into workers' heads and induce fear and uncertainty in the workers, all the while preventing those workers from having discussions about how it might be good to collectively bargain and stand strong together. This is why it's so important to cut this interim time as much as possible. There are other confounding issues surrounding timely elections as well. Things like employers challenging card signings in an effort to prevent a vote further down the line. There have been various bills introduced into both chambers of the House to alleviate this problem, all of them called Employee Free Choice Act. The EFCAs have all aimed at allowing a union certification upon the signing of more than 50% of workers to union representation cards, a true card check law. Upon hitting this 50-plus percent number, the right to demand a secret ballot election by the employer would be cast aside and the new union would be recognized. The EFCA would also have a few other effects, things like forcing employers and workers into binding arbitration for a contract if they can't negotiate it, and usually, I believe it's 3 or 4 months usually. It would also add rules and punishments for employers who retaliate against organizers. But that's all a little bit of a slight digression, I guess, and I apologize for that. So we have CEMEX, we have the final rule, and now the third and final NLRB piece that will complete this episode's little puzzle. Last year, yes, we are going all the way back to last year, the NLRB General Counsel Jennifer Abruzzo, this is Biden's appointee, she wrote a memo telling the NLRB and its regional directors to consider mandatory captive audience anti-union meetings illegal, at least under the National Labor Relations Act, the NLRA. This memo had been met with various legal challenges along the way through, you know, the past year plus, with Michigan and Texas being particular hotbeds of legal action. In Michigan, a challenge was summarily rejected by its state courts, and just a few weeks ago, on September 1st, a Texas district court wholly rejected a lawsuit filed by a group of staffing agencies. The Texas rejection was particularly brutal as the judge there ruled that, quote, in fact, plaintiffs do not even attempt to argue that Abruzzo's memorandum is outside of her prosecutorial functions. This concession is fatal. Prosecutorial functions are simply unreviewable. End quote. The law firm representing the staffing companies is quoted as saying that they are looking forward to challenging this ruling at the circuit court level. But from what I've been able to gather, their hopes are truly slim, short of judicial malfeasance. As the judge said, prosecutorial functions like these are literally immune from court involvement, and the entirety of the NLRA and the NLRB system would exclude district courts from even hearing these challenges. So let's take a look at the memo, which is spawning all of these legal fights. And I'm going to read a fairly long paragraph right now from this memo, then a couple shorter portions as we go on. Now, this memo is going to mention Section 7 a few times, and it's referring to Section 7 of the NLRA, which guarantees the right to organize, to form, join, or assist unions, and also the right to bargain collectively. So basically just the right to organize your workplace. Okay, so the memo says this, quote, I will urge the board to correct that anomaly and hold that, in two circumstances, employees will understand their presence and attention to employer speech concerning their exercise of Section 7 rights to be required when employees are, one, forced to convene on paid time, or two, cornered by management while performing their job duties. In both cases, employees constitute a captive audience deprived of their statutory right to refrain, and instead are compelled to listen by threat of discipline, discharge, or other reprisal, a threat that employees will reasonably perceive even if it is not stated explicitly. Inherent in the employment relationship is the understanding that employees cannot, without consequences, either fail to accede to their employer's stated requirements, e.g. that they attend a meeting, or abandon their assigned work duties, e.g. by walking away from their employer's speech directed at them as they work. Finding such mandatory meetings, including those termed as captive audience meetings, to be unlawful is therefore necessary to ensure full protection of employees' statutory labor rights. End quote. All of this is so important because before this memo, captive audience meetings were completely fair game for employers. They literally would tell us, and this did happen where I work, that these anti-union propaganda meetings were absolutely mandatory, and failure to attend would be met with punishment. We were told that we would be written up to file, and the prospect of being fired was certainly in the air. Employers are, by law, allowed to make a case against unionization, barring a few things like they are not allowed to outright lie, as an example. This has actually been ruled on a First Amendment free speech rationale. Of course, people should be allowed to speak, right? The problem comes when you compel other people to listen, especially under threat of retaliatory consequences. Quote, as the Supreme Court has recognized, employers' attempts to persuade the action with respect to joining or not joining unions are within the First Amendment's guarantee. But when to this persuasion other things are added which bring about coercion or give it that character, the limit of the right has been passed. End quote. This memo was spurred on, at least in part, by the absolute ghouls who run Amazon and how they decided to fight against the potential unionization of three different locations over the past few years, two in New York City and one in Bessemer, Alabama, a fight which we previously covered, if you're interested at all. But the fight Amazon waged was particularly brutal and relentless. The short of it is that Amazon committed a ton, just a massive metric fuckton, of unfair labor violations during these three elections. They placed illegal vote collection boxes on their campuses. They harassed organizers. They even went so far as to actually get the town of Bessemer to change the timing of the streetlight which led to the warehouse so that organizers would be less able to talk to their co-workers while they sat at the red light. That's how wild these dorks will get to prevent workers from exercising their legally protected rights. At JFK 8 on Long Island, the warehouse where the new Amazon labor union actually won, Amazon ran captive audience brainwashing meetings literally every single day for the 6 weeks leading up to the election, and these meetings ran continuously from 8 a.m. to 4 a.m., 20 hours per day, 7 days a week, for all 6 weeks. These meetings were, according to Amazon employees, intended to scare and coerce those employees and get them to vote no. All workers were forced to attend at least 2 meetings per week. Failure to do so was met with retaliation by the bosses. Some workers, after being subjected to multiple meetings per week for nearly 2 months, began repeating verbatim the company's reasons that they should vote no when asked why they might vote no or they did vote no. And this isn't even to mention the increased surveillance, punishments, and general pressure that these workers were subjected to force their vote in the company's favor. Further, the memo states that while employers will still be allowed to run these sorts of disinformation meetings, they must make it explicitly and obviously clear that its employees are entirely able to decide whether to attend or not, and they cannot wield, you know, any unspoken, veiled, or implied threats and leave those hanging over their heads, let alone actual punitive actions. Quote, to ensure that employees are not held captive to employer speech about their union or protected activity, I will propose that the board adopt sensible assurances that an employer must convey to employees in order to make clear that their attendance is truly voluntary. Such an approach will appropriately protect employers' free speech rights to express views, arguments, or opinions concerning the employee's exercise of Section 7 activity, without unduly infringing on the Section 7 rights of employees to refrain or not from listening to such expressions. End quote. Pretty simple, right? A freedom to speak is not a compulsion for anyone to listen or even for anyone to be there. While companies can speak and they can even ask us to listen, this memo and the ensuing legal challenges show that they simply cannot force workers to listen to their anti-union screeching. Now, before I wrap this up, there is one other item that happened last month at the beginning of August, and this is the thing that we can most directly tie to Biden himself, so I guess I'm going to give him one small nugget of a hat tip here, even though I don't want to. I really don't want to. The administration moved to redefine how prevailing wages are calculated for construction workers on federal and federally assisted jobs. This move was to fix a grave injustice from the deeply anti-labor presidency of Ronald Reagan, which changed how this figure was produced. Basically, the prevailing wage is the minimum wage for workers on federal construction projects. The prevailing wage rate is set by calculating the average wages of some percentage of workers in particular geographic areas. Before Reagan, it was 30% of workers. Reagan changed it to 50% of workers. And this change resulted in a drastic pay cut for these federal construction workers. Biden is restoring this equation to the pre-Reagan number. And this is really a throwback to the original Davis-Bacon Act numbers, the act which gave us the prevailing wage law. The Davis-Bacon Act will be applied to about at least $200 billion in federal and federally assisted infrastructure projects all around the country every year going forward. And these are huge numbers, and the results of this change will be significant. This will result in thousands of dollars going into the paychecks of workers on infrastructure projects, many of which are coming from the big infrastructure bill from the Biden administration. Yeah, this is at least partially and probably mostly, to be honest, a cynical ploy for labor's vote. But this is an unalloyed good, in my opinion, especially when you consider that many of these projects, a disproportionate amount, to be real with everybody, are slated to take place in deep red in mostly southern states where worker protections are low, union rates are low, and where the construction workers in these jobs are routinely underpaid, by penny-pinching actions so that the construction bosses can be made ever more rich. Now, this is a good way to use a federal law to protect workers, even where those in power are doing their best to suppress those same workers. All workers deserve to be paid for the full value of their work, the true value of their work. And I'm not even talking like profits are wage theft here. I'm just saying that these workers should be paid in full for the work that they do, no matter where they are doing it or who they're doing it for. This is a huge win for workers across the country. Now, as we, I guess I already said I was going to wind this up, but as we truly wind this up, I do want to caution everybody out there for one thing. This is not the end of the fight. In many ways, these rulings could and probably will have unseen effects on us as labor in this country. And what I would say here is that while these rulings are all good, and I truly believe that they are, they're good, they're just, and they're in the favor of workers, we should not be content to rely on the government and legal procedures, precedents, and laws to do the hard work for us. At the core of organized labor is the singular concept of solidarity, the unifying bond between all workers. We must remain as independent from the predations of a capitalist government as we do from the predations of the capitalist owners, lest we become the, you know, is cat's paws the right term? Puppets, unwitting pawns or something like that of the state, of politicians, political parties, or even just fundamentally corrupted by the close relations to all of those people and groups. It's up to the workers to strengthen ourselves, collectivize, resist, strike, demand, and fight for these things, not simply to sit back and rely on the NLRB to defend us. The law is only on our side so long as the enforcers are content to allow it to be so. Once they decide organized labor should no longer exist, or they've gotten too uppity, at least legally, all of that protection is gone in the wind, and all that will be left is the great mass of the workers in this country. And if that mass is not organized, unified, and harmonious, and focused on a goal, then we've already lost. Class war is a real thing. In fact, it's a core aspect of the world. A working class that waits on the enforcement of laws to do the work for them isn't doing the work. A proletariat that waits for the bourgeoisie to help them is not doing the work. The work to talk to each other, help each other, support each other, and build that class consciousness and solidarity. And perhaps a better way to say this is this. Let me think for a second. Workers, the working class, we are not free so long as we are reliant on the law and the state to protect and lead us, at the very least in its current state. Especially when the corporate dorks are one and the same as the government ghouls. To truly be free, the workers must be willing and able to override the puppeteered state through class-level action. And I hope that closing argument made sense, because this is the end of the episode. Thank you all for listening. I love you all.